You can be surrounded by the finest clocks and watches, but the question remains, what time do you set on them? You can have the finest clock, but how do you know what the time is? Since the 19th century then, how do you know what Greenwich Mean Time is to set on your fantastic Fremontiel long case, which I suspect you all have? I know I have several. So here we are. So this isn't a story about the science of time. It's a story about some people involved in time. It's a story about dirty tricks. It's about the pluck and resilience of one family who was selling time, who knew that you could sell time. Well, you can. And I'll be telling their story tonight. And the underdog won through, oh yes, in this fight against big business and commerce. And what else did I put in the title? And science, not much of that. And what we're talking about tonight, ladies and gentlemen, is the time on this line. It's the time at the Greenwich Meridian. The Greenwich Meridian here, pictured in the first of, welcome to my world, the first of many postcards from my private personal collection of postcards. I mean, eBay is an evil thing. It used to be that you'd spend your life scouring the boxes for postcards in markets and finding, you know, your niche, whatever it is you collect. In my case, photographs of the Prime Meridian. And now, of course, you just type into eBay. So now I have my salary paid directly to eBay. And if I'm lucky, I'll get some pocket money at the end of the month. Here we are. So a wonderful photograph from the early 20th century of a park attendant guarding, I like to think, guarding from theft the Prime Meridian, marked helpfully in the Royal Park, the Greenwich Park, in which the Royal Observatory is sat. Because when this photograph was taken, you couldn't go and visit it. It was an astronomical observatory. But here we are on the path. And in case you'd visited from wherever it was, around the world, to see the Greenwich Meridian, and somehow had forgotten by the time you got there which one it was you'd come to see, they put that nice sign there, pointing downwards, to say Greenwich Meridian, in case you were under any illusions. And I've kind of worked out that all this guy's job was to take photographs of souvenir hunters like these glorious Edwardian or slightly later ladies who wanted to have their photograph taken on the line. Now, I don't know how many of you have visited the Royal Observatory, have visited the Prime Meridian, the Greenwich Meridian. These days, forgive me for getting vulgar for just one moment, it's on the tourist trail for having your photograph taken, right? And nowadays, it's all about straddling the line with one foot in the east and one foot in the west. Or rather vulgar, I think. Nothing like that here. This is the early 20th century. This is polite society. That's a side saddle, dainty toe. Nothing so vulgar as to cross the line. So there we are, very, very popular right from the start to come and visit this site of science and this artifact, this strange artificial artifact of a meridian, which is simply a line that goes from the north to the south pole, and there's an infinite number of them. It doesn't just exist in the courtyard of the Royal Observatory. When I worked there, we had quite a job when we had to lock the gates at 5 o'clock, and people who were just a bit late saying, "No, I've come all the way from wherever to have my photograph taken on the Prime Meridian. Please let me in." And we'd say, "Sorry, we've got to lock up." And they'd say, "But," and we'd say, "But it goes all the way to the North Pole." Go outside. So there we are. Visitor attraction right from the start and to this day. So this was Vladimir Putin when he was the president who came to visit. I wasn't working there at the time, but I heard all of the stories because it was still fresh in everybody's memory. He brought his own security force, as you can imagine. So this isn't a joke. So there's lots of high turrets in an astronomical observatory. And so there were snipers in all of the high positions. And the Metropolitan Police had been pushed back, like behind their own cordon, somewhere in the car park. Putin's Secret Service looks after the observatory. I noticed that people were talking about the staff were hurriedly checking their tax discs were up to date that day as the car park was kind of full of the police. And whoever it was who snapped this shot of Putin Oh, the irony, stepping from the east into the west, ladies and gentlemen, must have dined out on it for years. So, it's always been a popular attraction. It's easy to find the line, but how do you find the time on the line? The time by the sun or the stars above the prime meridian, that's Greenwich Mean Time, and that's what this evening's talk is all about. So, souvenir hunters have come all the way. So, if you go to the exhibition now, you'll see things like radio-controlled clocks. They set themselves from a radio signal, which tells them what the time is. You might have them at home. But let's go back to the early 19th century. How did you know what Greenwich Mean Time was, the time kept by the astronomers at the Royal Observatory in Greenwich? Well, the only way to do that before 1833 was to knock on the door of the Royal Observatory at the top of the hill in the middle of a southeast London suburb and ask the astronomers, can you tell me what the time is, please? This was done. We know that this was done. For people who it was important that they knew GMT very accurately, we'll come on to who those people were in a moment, it was very important that, I mean, lives depended on this, they would send people to the Royal Observatory probably once a week with a pocket watch, and they'd knock at the door and ask for it to be corrected. And we know that this took place. So one of the groups of people who found it very important to know GMT were navigators on the ships on the Thames just down the hill from the Royal Observatory. If you go into the exhibition, you'll see marine chronometers. It wasn't about knowing the time so you know whether it's lunchtime. It was about a comparison between Greenwich time, a fixed time, and the time where you are on your ship when you're in the middle of the Atlantic. And that comparison gave you your longitude, your east-west position, and you knew where you were. And that's a good thing when you're in the middle of the Atlantic. This isn't the longitude lecture, so suffice to say, it was very important that the people who set off from the London docks knew GMT very accurately before they left. The other group of people who needed no GMT were the people who made those chronometers in the first place. So the trade that manufactured marine chronometers, very accurate watchers, portable timekeepers, who were based in the city of London, Clerkenwell, places like that. And we know that they did send the shop lad up the hill once a week or thereabouts to get the time. A stinging exchange reported in... if you wanted to have a stinging exchange in 1808, there was no Twitter. The equivalent of Twitter was the pamphlet system. This is my theory. I'm just trying it out on audiences. So people would publish pamphlets where they'd have a go at their rivals or whatever. They had some point to make. They'd publish a pamphlet, and then the other person would publish another pamphlet, and you'd have like Twitter wars, except separated by several weeks, which sounds like a much more civilized way to do things. So, stick with me on this. A stinging exchange reported in 1808 between two watchmakers, John Arnold and Thomas Wright. They didn't like each other. Arnold implied that Wright wasn't able to make a watch. He just employed people who made watches. He was just a businessman. And in any case, Arnold further implied, stick with me on this, Arnold further implied that Wright's watchmakers didn't know the time. Wright wasn't happy. He retorted in print, in a pamphlet, remember Twitter, 140 characters, "Mr. Arnold, it does not signify whether I can make a watch or not. I do not fear getting plenty of employ at mending thine." "And if my watchmakers do not know what o'clock it is, they can know by going to Greenwich for it as thee does." So evidence there that two of the finest watchmakers in London would, as a matter of course, send to Greenwich to get the time of day, to take it back to the shop, to set up those marine chronometers and pocket watches so they're beating perfect Greenwich seconds, so that when they end up on the ships and they're being used to navigate and lives are depending on the position being right, that it's keeping perfect time. Very, very important to them. However, it wasn't a particularly popular scheme with the astronomers. So they were getting interrupted on a daily basis. Throughout the day, people knocking at the door saying, "Can I come in and see your clock?" And being astronomers, they tended to work nights quite often, so they didn't like being woken up in... Thank you. It doesn't get any better than that. Being woken up in the day. So the astronomers were getting fed up. And by the 1830s, the astronomer royal, the chief astronomer at Greenwich, one of the highest scientific positions in Britain, wanted to devise two systems whereby, instead of people coming up the hill to find the time would go out to them. Two systems. Very neat. The first was in 1833. This is a time-lapse photograph of the Greenwich Time Ball, which is still in operation on one of the turrets of the Royal Observatory. The world's first public regular time signal. Still working today. It uses line of sight. You've got to be able to see it. And the way it works very quickly is it's normally at the bottom of the mast. At 5 minutes to one in the afternoon, it's hoisted halfway up the mast as a warning saying, get ready, the signal's about to arrive. 2 minutes to one, it was hoisted all the way to the top and it sat on latches until the instant of 1 o'clock, GMT, as measured by the astronomers there on site. The latches were pulled away, the ball dropped smartly, and that was the instant of 1 o'clock GMT. And if you go to the Royal Observatory now, you can see the old docks down the bottom of the hill, vice versa. If you're down in the old docks, you can see the Royal Observatory very clearly. Take a pair of binoculars, you can set your watches by the time ball at 1 o'clock in the afternoon. So it was a fantastic system for those who could see the Royal Observatory on the top of its hill. And it was a fantastic system when it worked. It didn't always work so well. The legend on this watercolour, the ball fell on December the 6th, 1855, drawn on the spot by Hubert Airy. Hubert Airy was the 17-year-old son of George Airy, who was the astronomer royal by the 1850s. And in a freak winter's gale, the ball was at the top of the mast, ready for the time signal. Wind gusted, it blew out one of the stays that held the mast up. It was top heavy, the thing crashed into the courtyard, and there we see the aftermath. To this day, the Royal Observatory doesn't operate the time ball in high winds. People might say, well, it's just health and safety gone mad, isn't it? Not at all. Right back to the 1850s, if that courtyard had been full of French school children, as it generally is now, it would have made a right mess of the cobblestones. So it's fine, and it was very popular as a tourist attraction, as the observatory itself was. Another from the Rumi postcard collection of an Edwardian scene, the legend of this one, if you can just about see it, watching the ball rise at the Royal Observatory, and the ball is in the halfway up position. And this gets me exceptionally excited. Normally, they're at the bottom. This one's halfway up. So you know that there was only 3 minutes in the day that that photograph could have been taken. And then when I found the one at the top of the mast, I was beside myself. Tragic. So to recap, all very well if you can see it, all very well if it's working. So fine for the navigating officers in the ships down in the Thames, but what about that other group of people that I told you about? What about the watchmakers, the chronometer makers in the City of London, in Clerkenwell? If you go there, a moment's inspection with binoculars will tell you that you can't see the Royal Observatory, so this was no good for them. So John Pond, back in the 1830s, had another scheme to deal with that audience, and that was to become known as the Belleville Time Service after the family that operated it. So in 1836, 3 years after the time ball started in operation, the chief assistant of the Royal Observatory, John Belleville, started carrying this pocket watch, made by John Arnold, as it goes, one of those pamphleteers, around subscribers in London who paid an annual fee to get a weekly visit from this, which had been corrected at the start of the day at the clocks at Greenwich. So this could tell you the time to a tenth of a second. The second hand operates five times a second, and you can, with careful reading, therefore double that for how accurately you can measure it to. That's possibly the worst sentence I've ever uttered. You can read this to a tenth of a second if you know what you're doing, is what I mean to say. And it was set right at the start of the day by the primary time standard of Britain, and then carried around people who paid this annual fee to get a look at the watch. Sounds kind of old-fashioned, certainly wasn't then, but we'll hear just how long it went on. But time to a tenth of a second actually is pretty good now. This is the clock that he would have set it against originally. You can see the watch, if you're interested, at the Clockmakers Company Museum in the City of London, a free museum. And this clock, which is at the Royal Observatory. And the service was a real hit. We'll find out just how much of a hit in a moment. John Bellville did it for 20 years, from 1836 until his death in 1856. And he was buried, in case you're interested in this sort of thing, in an old churchyard in Lee, which is just round the corner from Greenwich, about a 25-minute walk from the observatory. And he's buried under the grass just here. In case you're interested, this is an Admiralty vault, and it contains the remains of John Pond, who was the Astronomer Royal in the 1830s that I've already mentioned. It also has the body of Edmund Halley, of Halley's Comet fame, who was the second Astronomer Royal, so he's buried there as well. On his death, John Bellville's widow, Maria, asked the Admiralty whether he could be buried with John Pond, who had been essentially like a guardian to him from being a small boy. And the answer came back from the Admiralty, this is an Admiralty tomb, this isn't a tomb for civil servants, so no. And so he got buried just next to us, so not as close as he might have liked, but at least he was in the same sort of place. So I mentioned Maria Bellville, his widow. Let's meet her. Here she is in much later in life. This is the 1890s at a customer's premises in a bit of advertorial in the Graphic illustrated newspaper from the 1890s, 1892. What happened was on John Bellville's death in 1856, about half of the customers who were paying for that weekly visit got in touch with her and said, look, it's really important to us that we still get the time from you. Will you continue the service? And she said, well, I mean, I'm not employed by the Royal Observatory like John was, but I'll ask. And she did. She wrote to the astronomer. And the astronomer said, no problem at all. You can bring your watch. You can check it once a week. We'll give you a certificate to say how accurate the watch is. You didn't actually change the hands on the watch to set it right. You don't want to tamper with the hands. You might break it. You just say what the difference is between the time on the watch and real time. And you put that on a certificate, and you just have to do a bit of maths at the other end. So about 100 of the customers, about half of the customers that John Bellville had, continued the service. And Maria continued to carry that watch around those customers around London until 1856 to 1892, which is quite impressive. I think you'll agree she was in her 80s by the time she decided it was retirement. She was nearly blind by that point. And by that time, they'd had a daughter just before John died, Ruth Bellville. And Ruth had accompanied her mother around all of these time perambulations all of her life. I mean, there was no childcare, so she went where her mother went. So again, about half of the customers in 1892, when Maria retired, said, look, it's still important. We'd still like you to visit. Ruth, will you come around too? And she said, I don't know, I'll ask. She wrote to the astronomer then, and he said, that's fine, please do. So she continued the service for a further 48 years, before she herself retired, aged 86, in the year 1940. Not 1440. So, 104 years of unbroken service, with one family, just two generations, and one watch, carrying that watch from the Royal Observatory at the top of the hill, round subscribers in London, until the Second World War, this 18th century pocket watch. I mean, what a remarkable story. John had about 200 customers, Maria had about 100, and Ruth had 40 or 50 or thereabouts in 1908. She had some newspaper reports, and it gave us a bit of a glimpse into what her round involved. She said her service extends from the city to Kensington, from Baker Street to Chelsea. The business, she said, it's still flourishing. Many of the foremost chronometer manufacturers in the city are still glad to have my mean time. She, a little bit later, there was another newspaper report described again. So first she went to large industrial undertakings, which are found it essential to have correct time without fear of contradiction. Next, she said, the watchmakers in the Strand and the city are visited. And at the conclusion of a long tour, Bond Street, Regent Street and Mayfair firms are called on so that fashionable shoppers may set their watches by Greenwich. And altogether, it said, about 50 clients, including the houses of two millionaires, are visited each week. It's quite an important bit of technology going on there. But what have historians made of this Belleville time service as time has gone on? There have been a few who have written about time distribution, about history of the Royal Observatory, about that whole science of measurement and how measurement standards become mobile and transfer. Well, they've got nothing to say about the Belleville time service. The Standard History of the Royal Observatory, written in 1975, had this to say about Maria and Ruth's time visits. He said, Meadows was the author, he said, "In the later years, these visits were maintained more as a tradition than out of necessity. Much more accurate methods of obtaining time signals were by then readily available. Indeed," he said, "by the time of John Belleville's death, George Airy, the astronomer, had already started on a much better method for distributing time." So, Meadows, the historian of the Royal Observatory, 1975, is pretty damning here. Well, let's see that better method before I demolish all of those arguments for you tonight, ladies and gentlemen. Here, just to show you, you've already seen a picture on the poster outside, is Ruth Belleville in 1929. In that rather characteristic way that the newspapers showed all portraits, which just looked like they've had their throat cut. So here is the much better system. If you visit the Royal Observatory now, you can see this in operation. It's an electrical system invented by Charles Sheppard, which was installed at the observatory in 1852, the year after the Great Exhibition, where Sheppard had exhibited a prototype system. And here it is. It's really, really clever. So this is at the gatepost. It's not a clock itself. It's called a slave dial or a sympathetic dial, and it's connected just by electrical wires to a pendulum clock in the heart of the Royal Observatory, a very accurate pendulum clock, which sends out, every second, sends out electrical impulses to clocks like this. And anywhere you could string up an electric wire, you could have one of these slave dials, or sympathetic dials. It's just a couple of electromagnets and the hands and the gearing to gear the hands together. But the actual timekeeping was done by one clock, by one master clock, or motor clock, the driving force of this system, if you will. So a pendulum clock like the grandfather clock you might have, but a bit more accurate and modified to send these impulses, little bursts of electricity, to, let's say, advance the seconds hand, essentially, is what they're saying every second, or every 2 seconds, depending on how it works. Wonderful system, and these dials were strung up all the way around the observatory, but of course you can see that anywhere you can string a wire around the world, electricity travels kind of almost at the speed of light, so you can send time instantaneously wherever you want. It's no longer fixed to the spot. A very, very important conceptual development in time distribution. And you can see why historians would be seduced by the electric. I mean, it's electric. It's got to be better than an old woman with a pocket watch in a handbag. Or was it? It was a real tourist attraction as well. Here's a postcard that I probably bought after I had a couple of glasses of Merlot too many. I never really checked the description on eBay. You should. I thought it was a nice, clean version of the card, but then I found when I got it that it was covered in handwriting. But then I looked at the handwriting. It says here, "You can see the clock where I have marked it." And indeed, there is a splodge of pen where that clock is that I just showed you. I don't know who Jean was. I can imagine, I don't know if Jean's a man or a woman, but I can imagine that Jean's family had probably been regaled for weeks or months before this postcard was sent, saying, "I'll send you a postcard of this electric clock which I've been telling you about for like ever." And they're all saying, "No, there's no need, it's fine. It's fine, Jean, you just tell us about it when you get back." So here's a system. It was a tourist attraction, it was the electric, it was modern, it must be better, and it was set up in 1852, and you can see, it's got to be great. But I then told you that Ruth Belleville continued to be in operation until 1940, and that's through all of the early decades of the 20th century, when in times probably not too dissimilar to now, some really difficult times for businesses, depressions, crashes, and so on. People weren't paying money for things that they didn't need. People wouldn't pay a subscription, assuming it was more than just a tiny amount, for a service for their business that they didn't need through the 1920s and 30s. So it must have been important to them that Ruth continued to call. And so that got my kind of historian's hackles up. Was her service necessarily worse than this electric galvanic system? Was it necessarily less accurate? Was it necessarily less readily available? Because I'm interested in infrastructure. I'm interested in kind of the networks of technology that kind of we don't really see, especially in towns, is my interest. You know, the stuff that's hidden underneath the streets. Wires and relays and telegraphs and all of that sort of thing. And they're really complicated and they're really quite hard to keep working. How often does the broadband go down? Probably, you know, more often than never. Well, why would it have been any different that a really complicated system involving lots and lots of wires and relays and clocks and gears and switches? So, this idea that Ruth Belville was an anachronism must have come from somewhere. And I think I tracked it down to a lecture, probably not dissimilar to this one, held in March 1908 by a guy with the glorious name of St. Andrew St. John Wynne. St. Andrew St. John Wynne was speaking to the United Wards Club in Cannon Street in the City of London at one of their monthly meetings. And he was talking about time. And he referred to the work that Ruth and Maria Belville did in time. Her mother had died a few years before, and Ruth didn't know anything about this lecture, referring to her services. She was living in Maidenhead at this point. She knew nothing until 2 days later, when she got doorstepped by a couple of newspaper journalists who said they'd been to this lecture by St. Andrew St. John Wynne at the United Wards Club in the City of London. And the title of the lecture, they told her, was The Time of a Great City, a Plea for Uniformity. And here's what he said about Maria and Ruth Belville's service. This is what St. John Wynne said. All of the people in the audience were men. I've seen the minutes of the meeting. This was the people who, essentially the bigwigs, the people who ran the City of London. They got together as a talking shop once a month to talk about issues that affected the governance of the square mile. So they were bankers, mostly. And they were all men. That's important, I think. So he said this to this audience of chaps. It may be interesting and amusing to some of you to learn how Greenwich Mean Time was distributed amongst the clock and the watch trade in London before the present arrangements came into vogue. A woman possessed of a chronometer obtained permission from the Astronomer Royal of the time. Perhaps no mere man could have got it. Got permission from the Astronomer Royal to call at the observatory and have the watch corrected as often as she pleased. She then made it the business of her life until she reached a great age to call upon her customers with the correct time. And on her retirement, this useful work was, and even today is, carried on by her successor. Still a female, I think. Now, I don't mean to be funny, but exactly what do you think he meant by no mere man could have got permission from the Astronomer Royal, that bastion of high science, to get access to the clocks inside? Was he sort of suggesting, you know, all lads together, that she somehow flooded her eyelashes and used her womanly charms to seduce these crusty old men of science? Well, I mean, you could just say, come on, Rooney, it's just a chap trying to get the audience on side. It's all lads together. You know, he's talking about something. He just wants to have a bit of a joke to lighten the mood a bit. If that had been the only thing that he had been doing that year. But it turned out that March lecture was the conclusion of a 3-month propaganda campaign waged in the pages of the Times newspaper, in the letters and editorial columns, by the firm that he worked for, and him, and people who he knew. And this was the conclusion of it, which is all about time, and kind of the selling of time, and then he gave a lecture where he belittled the work of Ruth Belville. Well, we'll come on to that in a second. But, I mean, the reports got into all the newspapers about this lecture. It really did capture an interest. And Ruth Belville was really upset, as you can imagine, at the kind of her service had been called into question. She immediately, when these journalists left, she immediately wrote to the Astronomer Royal, essentially to say, I had no idea, nothing to do with me, I'm really sorry if this embarrasses you. She said, I lead so quiet a life that it is most unpleasant for me, particularly in a little town like Maidenhead, to have so much interference in my affairs. In the end, though, Ruth had the last laugh. As I've said, she continued the service until 1940. In fact, she got more customers because of this. She wrote later, I think that the Standard Time Company will not attack me again in public. As a result, ended in rather a heated discussion at the end of the lecture. And the last thing that Mr. St. John Wynne wanted was to advertise my chronometer at his company's expense, which was all the result he obtained. Go Ruth. So I actually worked, I think she got kind of 5 or 10 extra subscribers following all of the press attention. And St. John Wynne looked a bit of an ass at the end of that lecture, I think. Because St. John Wynne turned out to be the chairman of a company called the Standard Time Company. Interesting, Standard Time, I wonder what's going on there. This is his signature on some company documents. I mean, I don't want to turn this into a pantomime, but if you do want to boo when the pantomime villain is shown, feel free. I am setting up a villain of the piece here. He probably wasn't all that bad, but, you know, for the purposes of this, let's go with it. And interestingly, the Standard Time Company provided these. So these are standard wind-up clocks. There would have been countless clocks like these in offices, in factories, in shops, all over the place. They were good quality pendulum clocks, quite expensive but not too expensive, and you'd have needed one of these in every room of your factory building or your office complex or whatever, so people knew the time. And you'd need somebody to go around and set them right, as often as you wanted, probably once a week. And what they did with the Standard Time Company is that they'd modify your clocks, or they'd provide you with ones like this, with a little gadget on the top, like a set-top box for a TV now. It takes an old TV and gives it new functionality. It turns an analogue TV into digital without having to buy a new TV. Well, that's what this did for clocks. Right at the top there, an electrical device, which was then connected by electric wires throughout your office complex and then through the public telegraph network to their control station in Queen Victoria Street in the City of London. And every hour, their control station clocks would send out a burst of electricity, which would cause the hand, which would be near the top of the hour, to be grasped by two pins sticking through the dial, which snapped together when the impulse came through, physically dragging the hand to the top of the hour, like you would with your finger and thumb, and then leaving go of it the instant the impulse passed, thereby correcting every clock in your business once an hour to Greenwich Mean Time. It's a really, really neat technical system. It's like you correcting your clock once an hour. It could cope with like plus or minus a minute and a half. The hand would be within the embrace of those pins, and if your clocks couldn't keep time to a minute and a half in an hour, you needed new clocks. So it's a really neat system, but you can imagine that there was a lot of technology behind this to keep it working. All kinds of tech. So this is what the Standard Time Company provided. They provided time. They sold the time in the same way, but with very different technology, as Ruth Belville. So now we start to see that perhaps that carefully crafted slur was an attempt to cast her work in a bad light to get some business for them, because the problem with their firm was it was a very good technological system, but it was hemorrhaging cash because they needed to employ a lot of engineers to keep it running. The overheads were huge. The profit was almost never there for the business, whereas Ruth Belville, the overhead was that pocket watch and a bag and a cup of tea. And you got a bit of business gossip at the same time, because she'd been all of your rivals before she visited you. Which is not to be discounted, you know? It's these soft, intangible benefits that can tip the balance between one technology and another, discussed. But So that's, there it is, you can see that working at the Royal Observatory if you're interested. So now I think, I don't want to bang on, but I think that was a slur which was specifically designed to try and get some more business for the bottom line of the Standard Time Company, and it was designed to try to put Ruth Belville out of business, to suggest that her business was improper, to suggest that she shouldn't have access to this mail world with the scientists at one end, with the bankers and the merchants and the docks and all of that at the other end. And the fact that Maria and Ruth had navigated through that very complex gendered world for decades and had kept in business, I think, is an absolutely remarkable story in its own right. You know, we could talk about this all night. But let's get back to the observatory. So we've had our excursion to the Standard Time Company, but the historian had talked about George Airy's system, and this is what it was. So this wasn't a system that stayed within the walls of the Royal Observatory. This is the gate clock I mentioned. The Royal Observatory itself started to sell time signals in the same electrical way that the Standard Time Company did in about the 1870s. It was a kind of a joint venture, very popular today, joint ventures. Joint venture with the post office. So the Royal Observatory provided the time, and the post office provided the distribution infrastructure and did the billing and so on, and then gave a cut to the Royal Observatory. And you could rent a time signal from that joint venture. So that's the competition. I've kind of alluded to the fact, I'm kind of setting up here, that I don't think that electrical system was necessarily more accurate, more readily available, better than the Belville service. So I wanted to delve into this a little bit. So let's look at reliability and accuracy. I had a look at various sources of evidence. One was that article which had Maria Belville pictured in 1892, which had this line in the editorial: "Although mean time is supposed to be transmitted by electric current, it's a well-known fact that the correctness of the current is not to be relied on." Now, obviously, that's a puff piece for the Belville service, so they're gonna do down the electric service. But a well-known fact that the correctness isn't to be relied on. Okay, so that sent me to the archives of the post office and the Royal Observatory, so the two people who operated this service. Royal Observatory Archives are in Cambridge for some strange reason, and the BT Archives in Holborn in London. And I'm not joking, there's a file in each institution an inch thick. I'm not joking, an inch thick with very, very thin paper of memoranda, letters about failures in the time service. An inch thick in both institutions. So these are letters and memos going backwards and forwards between customers and them, between them, you know, between the post office and the Royal Observatory, Royal Observatory to the post office, about complaints and failures in this electrical time service. It went on for decades. I mean, the service started in the 1870s. I just sampled sort of the 1900s, 1910s, you know, decades. It should have been fixed by then. Numerous letters about failures. Post office to Royal Observatory: "We are getting the currents about 30 seconds slow." 30 seconds, that's not very accurate for a time service. Observatory to post office: "Through accidental derangement of our clock, the signal at 12 o'clock went out 1 second too late." That's 1 second, but that's still 10 times worse than Ruth Belville's. I hope I'm not labouring the point too much. Post office to Royal Observatory: "No time current received at 1 o'clock today." Royal Observatory to post office: "On arriving at the observatory this morning, I found that the 10 o'clock signal had been sent out 1 second and a quarter too late." One wonders how he knew he wasn't there, but of course they had a very clever system for finding out. So this much better, more accurate, more reliable and so on system perhaps wasn't so good after all. I mean, I'm paraphrasing those 2 inches of papers. Clearly, in a high-tech system, sometimes it fails. It was fine for most people who took the services. Most people didn't need a tenth of a second accuracy. Most people just needed it to be pretty good most of the time. But for some people, that wasn't good enough, especially those two groups and others for whom accuracy and precision and reliability were very important. And for those people, I argue, the Belville time service held on because it was the right technology. It was the right way of getting time, right up till 1940. I thought I'd do an analysis of cost, though, because it might have been that they were just using her service because she was really cheap. So, I've found out the costs of the three services. Post Office Royal Observatory Service, Standard Time Company, Mr. St. John Wynne, the Bellevilles. And I've normalised all of the costs to today's money, so, well, it was a couple of years ago, of the money it would cost today to buy an annual subscription. All right. So, top of the list, the Post Office and the Royal Observatory had an hourly service, and they charged you for that, the equivalent of £800 a year, to get an hourly time signal. Nobody took it up, it was hideously expensive, so they operated a stripped-down version of once a day, and they charged you £325 a year in today's money. So that's quite a lot of money, that's like two professional subscriptions. I looked at the Standard Time Company, and they charged the equivalent in today's money for an hourly correction of £85 a year. That's more like it. You could imagine a firm paying £85 a year to get that. So, if Belleville was much cheaper than that, then that's the reason. Of course, she wasn't. She was actually about halfway between the two. She charged about the equivalent of £150 a year to get the weekly visit. So people were paying good money for the Bellevilles. And that's my argument, you know, partly, that people would only pay for services that were appropriate to them. I've probably gone on long enough about that service. So we enter the 20th century. She keeps going until 1940, but I will concede that there were some reasons why the service might have started to come to an end in the 20th century. The first service, which started to be a real competitor, was wireless. Time by wireless. So now you can get these correcting clocks and watches that I mentioned. Well, here's Rugby Radio Station, now pretty much no longer. Most of those wonderful masts which held up huge aerials you used to be able to see from the motorway, the one that goes up the left-hand side of the country, I don't drive. Which one would that be? The something or other. Or the West Coast Main Line, if you go on the trains that... if you go on the Pendolinos that make me vomit. Must learn to drive. Curator of transport is embarrassing. Anyway... The Rugby Radio Station was set up in the 1920s, and from 1927 it started broadcasting coded time signals by wireless. It was pretty tough to understand what was going on. You needed a decoding chart, and you needed some pretty good receiving kit to get the services. That had been started in 1909, 1910 by time signals from the Eiffel Tower in Paris. Weren't allowed to have wireless receiving kit in the First World War. That would have been confiscated. So it was only really in the 1920s that people would start to have the receiving kit to get wireless signals, and time signals were very early uses of that. So it was very large, it was very expensive, so it wasn't immediately a competitor for those time firms, in London at least. In the 1940s, a new service started called MSF, which is the same as the service you can still get today. It's no longer from Rugby, it's from Cumbria, but don't need to go there. Well, you wouldn't want to go there. It's Cumbria. I gave this talk, actually. There's the radio broadcasting station for the time signal that keeps your watches right now, if you've got radio watches. It's this little spit of land called Anthorn. I gave a talk once, and I was dissing Cumbria, as I tend to do. I'm from the northeast. You wouldn't have guessed it from the accent. And he said, I've lived in Cumbria all my life, and I've never heard of Anthorn, so it's pretty remote. However, the radio that might have been more familiar in the 1920s was not that high-tech coded stuff, but the BBC, founded in 1922, the British Broadcasting Company, for listeners in. So this wasn't dots and dashes of Morse code. This was people singing and the light programme and chat, and people like Arthur Burroughs telling you what the weather was going to be doing. And then they realised that there was a real market to give time signals out on the BBC. So right from an early age, right from the start of the BBC, Arthur Burroughs and people like him would give out the time, originally just by looking at their wristwatch and then saying the time is 7 o'clock. Of course, was his wristwatch set correctly? We don't know. 1923, this is a book published in 1923, the picture there shows Arthur Burroughs with a set of tubular bells behind him, specially tuned to the Westminster chimes. And they used to play the Westminster chimes on the tubular bells into the microphone, and that would be the time signal. how did they get the time for that? Well, the broadcast studios at that point were on the banks of the River Thames. They hadn't moved to Broadcasting House at this point. They were in a place called Savoy Hill, on the banks of the Thames. Now, if you get your vintage map of London out, you'll see that the Houses of Parliament are just along the river, with a big clock, commonly known as Big Ben. Of course, I know it's just Bell, but anyway, Big Ben's just down the river. And so I reckon what they did, and I've stood in the room where they would have, where this was taken, I opened the windows, the wind is in a favourable direction, you could hear, hark, is that Big Ben? And play along in the Tubular Bells, getting your time from Big Ben. What an unimpeachable source. But, I can see etched in your faces tonight. But David, what about the speed of sound? Wouldn't take that into account, did they? So this time would be going out late. So I worked out precisely what would have been the time delay if they were playing along with Big Ben. I got my vintage ruler out on my vintage map. I probably could have just used a modern one. It hasn't moved. To measure the distance between Big Ben and the window out of shot here. And I found that the time would have been going out, ladies and gentlemen, 2.5 seconds late. Now, thank goodness the BBC would never do anything now about giving out a time signal that's meant to be accurate, but in fact it's about 2.5 seconds late. Oh, hang on a minute. Digital radio. If you've got a digital radio, it's 2.5 seconds late. They haven't told you. You're listening to the pips. They haven't told you they're late. It's true. If you listen on analogue and in the kitchen and a digital radio, it's about 2.5 seconds. Depends on the manufacturer. You can actually, a little tip is, I've made a lot of money at Ladbrokes because I listen to horse races like this. That's the worst joke in the world. So there we are. They knew that this system couldn't go on. This wasn't the high-tech BBC that we came to grow and love. And so in 1924, just 2 years after the BBC was founded, the Six Pips were instituted. So we now know the Six Pips. Anywhere in the world that you can hear the BBC on the World Service, you can hear the Six Pips. It's an automatic service. It doesn't involve Arthur Burroughs's wrist, tubular bells, and the Big Ben. It was a very neat system set up as a joint venture between the Royal Observatory and the BBC, where the Royal Observatory would provide the time, the BBC would provide the distribution infrastructure, the radio broadcasters, transmitters. And there was a clock set up, this clock, set up at the Royal Observatory with special electrical contacts, which would send little bursts of electricity, 6 bursts of electricity every 15 minutes, as it happens, which would be sent up a rented telephone wire from Greenwich to Savoy Hill, where they'd be turned into audio tones that you could hear, or pips, and then they could be broadcast if they were required. And you had an unbroken chain, almost, from the stars above Greenwich, used by the astronomers to set right the clocks. The clocks then electrically would send the time to the BBC. No person involved, nothing to go wrong, and it would be broadcast. And that is basically the system that still applies, except the time comes from American military satellites, rather than the British radio time system, but that's another story. So there we have the Astronomer Royal looking uncomfortable. I suspect, having done a few photo calls myself for the press, that he was in that position for about half a day. That's still there, you can still see that. It was replaced by quartz clocks in the 1940s, and now it's atomic clocks with radio correction and so on, all very clever. So there we are, the Six Pips still going strong. It was a way that people could get access to very accurate split-second GMT from the 1920s. And then in the 1930s, another time service came along. Tim the talking clock. Tim, after the letters that you would dial on the alphanumeric telephone dials of the day, the speaking clock, anytime you want it, you don't have to wait for the BBC to pip at you, you don't have to wait for Ruth Belville's visit, you don't have to decode anything, you just pick up, you dial Tim, you pay a couple of pennies, and you get the time. What a wonderful system. Interestingly, it came about exactly for the same reasons as the Belville time service was set up exactly 100 years earlier. This was the post office who ran the telephone networks, a network of exchanges, the exchange operators who connected your calls day or night. You didn't dial direct at that time. And people knew that you would be able to dial the operator for nothing, day or night, And every exchange had a good quality clock on the wall. They needed time for their billing purposes and so on. So people were just ringing the operator to ask for time. Didn't want to call connecting, they just wanted to know the time. And it was tying up the lines that the post office could have been using to connect calls. So once again, there was this drain on resource that the astronomers had had 100 years earlier. And like the astronomers, they wanted a system, instead of people coming to them, that time would go out to the people. So why not build a clock that talks, shove a couple of 100 telephone lines into it, and people ring a special number and get the time. And again, it was connected directly, electrically, to the Royal Observatory, so the time was accurate. Massive success right from the start. But if you build a clock that's... that talks, you're going to need a voice in the first place. Now, the post office in 1935, when they were setting up the system, were quite reasonably tight, and they didn't want to pay royalties on a voice that might be heard by countless millions of people. So they wanted a voice, and they had a competition in-house. So they could just pay a one-off fee of 10 guineas, 10 pounds and 10 shillings, for the voice, because it would be done in the course of employment, that would be it. I've written a book like that. Luckily, it's not selling, so no problem with lack of royalties. And so they had an X Factor-style competition amongst all of the exchange operators throughout the telephone network. So there were thousands of women, mostly a teenager in their early 20s, of women who operated these exchanges, who pretty much every single one applied to be the girl with the golden voice. This competition dreamed up by the new PR department that the post office had set up with a very energetic PR guy who knew that you could have a competition, you could get a lot of publicity, you'd get people ringing the speaking clock, making revenue for the post office because they wanted to hear the girl with the golden voice. Voices were really in the 1930s. I've got a whole other lecture that I could bore you with. But here is the final of this, like the X Factor, there were regional heats all around the country as the girls were whittled down to just 9 finalists. And here is the judging panel in a lecture theatre in St Martin's Le Grand, which is a street in the City of London near St Paul's Cathedral, where BT headquarters still is, different building. And the girls were in another room speaking Milton poetry, L'Allegro, if you're interested, all twisted eglantines and so forth, into a special telephone microphone being listened to on golden telephone handsets here in the judges' panel. And I've even... this is a still from a Pathé newsreel, and I've also seen the kind of the order form for these golden handsets, which I've been checking out on eBay for many years, haven't found one. And they were listening to make sure that the voices heard through the telephones could be understood, because the frequency response through those systems was very restricted, so it needed a certain type of voice. I think mine probably wouldn't have gone down too well. We'll see just how well in just a moment. So what about this terrifying judges panel for all of these 19-year-old girls from, like, Hull, who've come to London for the day, and from left to right, and I'm sorry, I'm going to lapse into my Pathé newsreel voice because I've seen this too many times. From left to right, Mr. Stuart Hibbard, chief announcer of the BBC. That's a pretty heavy word there. The actress, Dame Sybil Thorndike. There she is, looking very grand. I should like to hear it with more vim, I think she said at one point. Mr. John Masefield, the poet laureate, who actually set the voice tests and chose Milton's L'Allegro, because to be able to read poetry well, he said, a girl must be beautiful in mind and beautiful in voice to be able to read such poetry well. And then the next one, which I think is wonderful, Mrs. Atkinson, chosen as the perfect telephone subscriber. They'd had like a parallel competition which would pick like the subscriber who would have a really good relationship with the girls who connected the call. And Mrs. Atkinson was brought down from Burley and Wharfdale especially for the day, and there was some corruption going on there which I haven't yet bottomed out, but some people knew some people, and she wasn't as wider than wide, not a bit of it. It was corrupt, I tell you. And then Major Tryon, this isn't being recorded, is it? Major Tryon, the Postmaster General, is on the end, I mean, what a remarkable scene there, picking the finalist who did win through there, Ethel Kane, a Croydon woman, reading the script there. There are 79 phrases that make up the speaking clock, and I've had the doors locked, so you're not allowed out until you do the test, which is exactly what those 79... You can work it out, and it's an absorbing way to spend 10 minutes. Ed the Third Stroke is wonderful, I'll give you that one. She's reading out the phrases to be recorded. Now, I was interested in the other finalists, the other eight, the losers, as I like to think of them. And I was doing some research for the book that I think I might have just mentioned that I wrote, which talks about Ruth Belleville and also a little bit about the girl with the Golden Voice competition. I was really interested to see that one of the finalists who didn't win was from the South Shields Exchange in the North East. Now, that's my town, that's where I was born, that's where I was brought up. And I was wondering, how come at history class at school, we didn't get told that one of our local lasses was nearly the most listened to voice in Great Britain? So I looked into this further, ladies and gentlemen, as is my historian's wont, and I looked into John Masefield's notes that he wrote at the final, and also the tests that he'd set up. And he had a real problem with regional accents. He really didn't like regional accents. So he said, there must be no trace of a regional accent in final voice. And then I read the notes afterwards. He said, and in none of the finalists could there be found any trace of a regional accent, except one, and that was a northern one. So I'm afraid it was the local lass who let the side down there, and so I wrote the book, and it got published, and I sent a copy to my mother, and she read it, which was nice. I suppose somebody had, and she hasn't paid me for it, actually, interestingly. And she said, read the book. I says, ah. Says, that exchange operator from South Shields. I says, aye. She said, you related. And she's actually a relative of me. So I am genetically, ladies and gentlemen, genetically a Greenwich Time loser. So in the 1930s, the speaking clock came along and you could pick up the phone any time you want and get the time for a penny or two. The pips were coming out of the radio. You might be able to get the time from rugby. And then the electrical services were still going on. They might have fixed the relays by then. And through all of that, I can understand that by 1940, Ruth Belleville decided it was time to call time on her service. It was in the Second World War. She, at that point, lived just near Croydon Airport, which was a major target for bombing. The Royal Observatory got bombed, a direct hit, just a couple of days before she was due to visit 1 week. And when she went in to see her customers in town, which was in the docks, in the Docklands, and in the City of London, as you can imagine, I mean, she did not know from 1 week to the next which street she normally passed down would still exist, never mind which of her customers would still be alive, would still be around. I mean, London completely dislocated, and what a time to be travelling through the streets in your mid-80s at the end of such a long business. And so she decided to retire at 1940 and just stay in the cottage. She lived for another 3 years until she died in 1943. I think she knew that the speaking clock really was the downfall of her service, Tim the talking clock. She was visiting one of her customers, Mappin and Webbs, the jeweller still going, and she was having a cup of tea with her contact there, and she's reported to have said, Tim, such a vulgar name, don't you think? And then when she died in 1943, the News of the World reported her passing with an article entitled Human Tim Found Dead from carbon monoxide poisoning after having turned the gas mantle by her bed low to conserve gas, and the gas companies had omitted to tell customers that if they did that, they might suit up and kick out poisonous fumes. And Ruth Belleville died in the Second World War, not from the bombs, not from the dislocation of London, but from trying to do her thing for the war effort. You know, I think it's probably time that I started to shut up. So, Know Me A Man could have done what the Bellevilles did. Was that what St. John Wynne was suggesting? Well, I think, you know, really, perhaps he was right on the money. Perhaps Know Me A Man could have navigated such a route through science, through commerce, through measurement, through technology and science. I think it was a remarkable story. I think it was more important, perhaps, than some of my predecessors would have liked to think. It kept London on time in a small way for over a century, and I think it was a pleasure to research it and a pleasure to talk to you tonight. So I'm going to shut up, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you very much.